And episode number 22 of the Pinstripe Lanes podcast brought to you by the high-speed Wi-Fi American Airlines offered so that I could edit this week's episode.
Welcome to the Pinstripe Lanes podcast. Here's radio host and lifelong Yankees fan, Ralphie Aversa.
Welcome to episode number 22. I believe this is, episode number 5 inside season 2 of the Pinstripe Lanes podcast. I'm Ralphie Aversa, at Ralphie Aversa on all social networks. We're at Pinstripe Lanes, wherever you find us, whether it's iTunes or Google Play or Spotify or anywhere else. Please rate, review, subscribe, and tell a friend. Tell your friends. All right. A lot of energy on this Thursday morning. We usually drop Wednesday afternoon, and that was the plan this week. Up until Saturday, then things got a little iffy when I got a call from my friends at Dick Clark Productions and they wanted me to fly to Vegas to be the warm-up act for the, was it sixth or seventh straight year? I've been at the Billboard Music Awards since 2013. I've been doing this warm-up act thing since 2014. I go on stage before the show begins and during commercial breaks to hype up the crowd, tell them what's coming up next, so on and so forth. And so I figured, okay, well, with the Billboard Music Awards being on Wednesday, they were last night. And by the way, I'm taping this from New York. I took the red eye back. I was literally in Vegas for 24 hours. I edited a good amount of this week's episode on the plane ride to Vegas. The plan was to tape my open and close in my hotel room and then hopefully drop it last night before I left Vegas or on the plane ride, and Vegas happened. Not the typical Vegas trip, though. This is the first time first of all, I've never gone to Vegas for just 24 hours, but it's the first time that I've gone to Vegas and haven't gambled. Really didn't drink either, for that matter, but didn't gamble at all. Was going to try to get a bet in on yesterday's game. Thank goodness I did not, because I would imagine, I don't know if the Yankees were getting or giving runs, actually. So I don't know. Maybe if they were getting runs, maybe that would have been a good bet. But didn't even have time to go to the sports book at the MGM Grand where I was staying. Was getting the updates while I was in dress rehearsal at the Billboard Music Awards. I feel like every time, you know, I was like backstage at the American Music Awards, you know, when Sanchez hits that long fly ball and we end up losing to the Red Sox. And then I'm at the Billboard Music Awards when we lose to the Diamondbacks. So not a lot of good juice, as our guest last week would say. Not a lot of juice there when you're talking about me at award shows trying to keep up with the Yankees. Nonetheless, you don't care about award shows. You care about our beloved Yankees. Although I will say one quick aside. There was one Yankee-related thing that happened to me while I was backstage at the Billboard Music Awards. The dressing room that I was using as the, because it's like you're treated as a performer essentially, only you're just not on the telecast, but you're on stage, you know, there's makeup and wardrobe and all that fun stuff. The dressing room that I was using was in the same neck of the woods as Sierra's dressing room. And so I ran into, later in the evening, Seattle Seahawks quarterback and New York Yankee Russell Wilson Jr. III. Did say hi to Russ. He said hello back. That was cool. So yeah, there's my one little Yankee note from my 24 hours to Vegas. All right, to the Yankees and to this week's guest. He's the first. Hold on. I'll save that for the intro. He was great last year on the Pinstripe Lanes podcast. We had to bring him back, especially now that his full-time job is really in full swing as the editor-in-chief of Baseball Digest. Of course, for 11 years, he was the head of PR for the New York Yankees during all the championship years, those dynasty years in the 90s and early 2000s. The one, the only, Mr. Rick Cerrone. Got a lot of great stories for us again. He joins us right now on episode 22 of the Pinstripe Lanes podcast. And welcome back to the Pinstripe Lanes podcast. I'm Ralphie Aversa. Our guest this week on the Pinstripe Lanes podcast is the first non-contributor we've asked back for a second interview. Now we'll give you a number that actually matters. He's only the fourth editor-in-chief in the 77-year history of the legendary publication Baseball Digest. His career in sports and media spans over four decades. Of course, he spent 11 of those years manning the hottest seat in sports as the senior director of media relations for the New York Yankees from 96 to 06. He's also an adjunct professor at Iona College, consultant, and motivational speaker. We welcome back onto the Pinstripe Lanes podcast, Mr. Rick Cerrone. Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm great, Ralphie. That's a great intro, but since the last time we spoke, it's now 78 years, the history of Baseball Digest.
So. Oh, 78. Okay. So,
I'm still here.
We'll add one more on to that. And I know last year you took on this gig at Baseball Digest as the editor-in-chief. Why did you do it?
Well, it was a great challenge. Ownership made a decision that, one, they were outsourcing everything. And number two, they basically wanted to reimagine an iconic brand that was clearly distressed. And when I say distressed, most people that I talked to last year when I did my due diligence about this, you know, people in baseball from, you know, Bob Costas to general managers to PR directors, they all would say, oh my God, I read that. I used to collect on this and that. I didn't know it was still around. So we really had our work cut out for us, and I've been doing this now a little less than a year. My first issue was the September-October issue of last year, and I couldn't be happier with where we are, where we've been, and the direction of the magazine.
What was the biggest challenge, I guess, facing you, or the biggest issue that you've had to tackle since becoming editor-in-chief?
Well, number one, I think the magazine needed rethinking in terms of its direction. You know, we come out six times a year right now. We hope that'll be more in the future. But, you know, we've got to tell compelling stories that haven't been told about the game and the people in and around the game. And that's what we've set out to do, and I think we've been really successful. We've had some terrific stories, great photography, great writers. But the biggest challenge, I think, or the first challenge, let's say, was to re-engage Baseball Digest first with the baseball community. I mean, we were just not on the radar of the teams. I'll give you an example. One of the things I learned last year, and again, doing my due diligence before accepting the position, was that Baseball Digest had presented a Player of the Year award since 1969, which meant that last year, my first year, would be the 50th presentation of or awarding of a Player of the Year award. And I say awarding rather than presenting because they had never presented anything.
Wow.
They had never even given an award. So they had three premier awards, the Player of the Year, the Pitcher of the Year, which they began in 1994, and the Relief Pitcher of the Year, which they started back in 2012. So this was the first time, one, we had a panel of baseball, knowledgeable baseball people. I mentioned Bob Costas, Chris Russo, Harold Reynolds, Steve Phillips, Bill Madden, a 15-member committee that selected the awards. We got great visibility and exposure when we made the announcement, and that's something they had never done before. They had never announced the winner. We got great visibility there, and then we set out to actually present a magnificent award. It's a 18-pound clear crystal memento, and inside the memento is a three-dimensional etching, a full figure etching of the player. So the Player of the Year was Mookie Betts, the Pitcher of the Year unanimously was Jacob DeGrom, and the Relief Pitcher was Blake Treinen of the Oakland A's. And last week we made our presentations on the field at their home ballparks.
I did see you across town at Citi Field presenting that very beautiful memento, as you described, to Jacob DeGrom as well. And it's interesting, you know, you bring up Mad Dog. He was my guest last week on this podcast.
Oh, wonderful. That was a more exciting show than this one will be. I can assure you that.
That's
a good job there by Ralphie.
He gave me one of those at the end of the podcast, and I was actually very excited about that. Here's something we chatted about, though. You and I guess, have already discussed this just now with as it relates to Baseball Digest. But I think what I find interesting about what you're doing at Baseball Digest and the challenges that you face is that I feel like this conversation is also happening on a broader level with baseball as a whole. So, and I talked about it last week with Doggy, the idea of, you know, the fact that you know, the NFL releasing its schedule takes top billing over what's happening in baseball in this first month of the season. Obviously, you're also competing with NBA playoffs, NHL playoffs. Do you see Baseball Digest, after it reengages the baseball community, I guess also helping baseball to kind of regain some of its relevancy?
Things are going to happen during the course of a long baseball season. The mistake I think that people make when they compare sports is it's comparing apples to oranges. Football is an event-oriented sport. Every game they play is an event. Let's take the New York Giants, for whom I've been a season ticket holder for 35 years, right? They play 8 regular season games a year. They are events. This is something that we addressed back 30 years ago when I was with the Pittsburgh Pirates, that the Pittsburgh Steelers, and everybody said, oh, it's a football town, it's a football town. Yeah, but it only takes a commitment of 8 games. You know, baseball, you're out there 80 times a year, and you've got to make those as event-oriented as possible, because many of them are, you know, go to multiple games, but sometimes you get the fan that goes to one game. So I don't think you can compare the sports, and I don't think baseball should be concerned about what's going on around. They just need, and I think that's what they're doing, is, you know, just to protect and enhance their own house.
I agree. I think to some level it's hard to compare. That said, though, I mean, you look at the culture that's built around a sport like the NBA, where it's year-round, you're talking about trades and transactions. And then, of course, there's the whole, you know, there's the sneaker part of it and the clothing part of it as well. And there's a whole culture. I mean, can baseball take anything from that and implement it? I mean, and even from a content standpoint, do you think that there's something there for a Baseball Digest, or is that not the case?
I think baseball and Baseball Digest just has to put out the best possible product they can. And that right there, that's an issue. And this is not meant to be critical of baseball, because, you know, they're facing this challenge head on. The goal of a general manager, of a team president, of a manager is to win baseball games. I had a manager one time tell me, when they were talking about speeding up the game, right? So what you're saying is, you're happier with me if I lose a game in 2 hours and 30 minutes rather than I win a game in 3 hours and 30 minutes. Because the one obstacle is the people putting the ball club on the field and the people on the field, they're not really that concerned about pace of play. That's why baseball had to go in and create these rules, right? Artificial rules like mound visits, which I happen to think is a good rule, because it really got out of hand. But the beauty of baseball was it was the only game without a clock. Well, if you go to a ballpark now, you see 2 or 3 clocks. You know, there's one clock to tell the time between innings. There's another clock after each play to tell how long a manager can challenge the play. You know, they're experimenting with the pitch clock, which is annoying as heck. Especially in spring training, when, you know, the pitch clock wouldn't be in effect if runners are on base, but the pitch clock still goes and it really is meaningless. So I think that there's a lot of challenges facing baseball. The analytics of the game, I keep saying, this is not a science project. You know, this is not an insurance actuarial table. It might be great to say we're counting cards, right? But that's not really that exciting for fans to watch. I think it's a little dangerous.
Rick Cerrone, editor-in-chief of Baseball Digest, joins us here right now on the Pinstripe Lanes podcast. I'm Ralphie Aversa. I noticed on the season preview cover, Aaron Judge graced it. Do we have a face of baseball right now or no?
Well, you know, I think that Aaron Judge was, you know, rapidly becoming the face of baseball. The way he did it so quickly is really an incredible story. But, you know, I think there's a lot of faces. There's not one real face of baseball right now. You've got Mike Trout. You've got Mookie Betts. You know, there really isn't that one guy. There's not the Willie Mays and Hank Aaron and Mickey Mantle playing at the same time.
Let's transition for just a minute to somebody who may have at one time been considered the face of baseball. And that, of course, is Derek Jeter, the former shortstop for the Yankees. I'm sure you get asked about working with him a lot. Is there any story that sticks out, or just any general sense about working with him throughout the season that kind of stuck with you over those years?
I can give you a couple, summing it up in a couple of ways. I could tell you 100 stories, but what I say about Jeter is when I was with him, and I'm speaking 1996 when he was a rookie to 2006, that's 11 seasons. I'm speaking of those 11 seasons. When I left and people asked me about Derek Jeter, right, I used to kid and said, well, he had no use for me. And they'd say, what? You didn't get along with him? I said, no, we got along great. But he didn't need a PR guy.
Right.
he didn't need someone to tell him. I mean, most players, right, not most players, but many players, you know, they've got a lot of things on their mind. So if they're doing the, whether it's an interview with the Minneapolis Star Tribune or the Sunday Conversation on ESPN, you've got to remind them. You've got to put something in their locker, you know, hey, you know, when he gets to the ballpark, remember it. But that was not Derek Jeter. He never needed to be reminded about things. I can honestly say what I was starting to say before, in the 11 years I was with him, I never saw him do the wrong thing. I never saw him greet somebody. Every man was sir, every woman was ma'am. And another example is, let's say he's meeting a Make-A-Wish kid before the game, or the son of a sponsor. Let's say we've got some arranged meeting with a kid who's coming to the game to meet him for whatever the reason may be, right? Most players, you know, you'd remind them a bunch of times, they'd do it, they'd be nice. And while they're at the meeting, the player would say, hey, run into the clubhouse and get Robbie Cucuzza, the clubhouse manager, to grab a bat. And then I go in, I'd bring the bat out, he'd sign the bat or whatever. Jeter would give him the bat that he was using.
Wow.
You know, he'd give him the bat. He, you know, he never had to ask for anything. I'm a big student of Walt Disney. And one thing about Walt Disney is he had a saying where he believed in plussing every experience. His accountant one time said, you know, you're paying all this money for this 3 o'clock parade, but, you know, people aren't coming to Disneyland for the parade. It's not a draw. And he said, but it's plussing the experience, so we're going to keep doing it. Derek Jeter plussed every experience that he was involved in.
There was a story you told me though when we chatted during last season of the podcast that sadly hit the editing floor because there was a lot of good stuff from that, and we were at the time trying to keep it to around 30 minutes. But you had told me a story about you and Joe Torre walking out of the clubhouse and running into Sarah Jessica Parker and her husband Matthew Broderick at a game, and I. You got to have a lot of stories, I think, over that time, and especially with all the championship years of public figures and celebrities at games. Besides that one, does any other one stick out or no?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, when you tell your listeners that we ran into Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker, the perspective of it, we had just lost a big postseason game, and we were walking out of Joe's office to go to the interview room. You know, walking right in front of us was Sarah Jessica Parker and Matthew Broderick. And they were walking in front of us. And when they turned around and saw us, they jumped out of the way. And Sarah Jessica Parker said, I'm so sorry. We didn't mean to, you know, get in your way. And Joe Torre said, don't be sorry. You're the highlight of our evening. But Ralphie, I got to tell you, and I'm probably going to write something about this in one of my first pitches. I have a column in each Baseball Digest. And I like to make every other one about some personal thing that I was involved in or some good story, and maybe sometime it'll be a Jeter story or whatever. But young people won't remember this, but older people will remember the old Dean Martin show on television on NBC in the 60s and early 70s. And he had a bit where he'd be sitting around. It was a very casual thing. And he'd go, I think I'll go to the door. And he would go to this door on the stage, and he'd open the door. And you never know who was going to be in there. It could be John Wayne. It could be Ronald Reagan. It's always somebody, you know, surprising was behind that door. And that's what I likened being the PR director of the Yankees or even at the commissioner's office when I worked there. When that phone rang, it could be, you know, Jack O'Connell from the Daily News or Bill Madden or any of the media people that would call. But it could be Walter Cronkite. It could be Oprah Winfrey. It's amazing the people, you know, one time, you know, we had a senior advisor named Arthur Richmond who had the office next to me, and Arthur knew everybody. And he was very close to the Bush family. I mean, really close. They loved him. And one time early on, the phone rang and my administrative assistant, Matilda, answered the phone and said, hold on, please. And she said, Arthur, do you want to talk to George Bush? And Arthur's response was, which one?
Oh, wow.
And she said, I think it's the father. Okay. So, not that he wasn't going to talk to the president, but,
right.
But you know, and then Arthur would answer the phone, Bushy, my baby. I mean, like, so that was one of the great things. You never knew who you, what I wrote about in this current issue of Baseball Digest was, the highlight of my years with the Yankees, you know, off the field, so to speak, was that I was a big fan of the movie Pride of the Yankees. I mean, who hasn't seen Pride of the Yankees? And Gary Cooper's co-star was Teresa Wright, a beautiful young actress in the 1940s, nominated for Best Actress for that movie, and actually won for another movie the same year, won Best Supporting Actress for Mrs. Miniver. Well, I'm watching the Academy Awards in 1998, and there she is. They introduced all the people that had ever won an Academy Award. And I said to myself, that's Teresa Wright. She played Eleanor Gehrig, Pride of the Yankees. We should get her to throw out a first pitch. So I got Mr. Steinbrenner's permission. He thought it was a great idea, and I set off on this search for Teresa Wright. I got her agent's name, and I called him up, and I explained what we wanted to do, and he said, well, Rick, that's a very nice gesture, but I don't think she'll do it. And she only lived about 40 miles from the stadium.
Uh-huh.
You know, she could have lived anywhere in the country, but she lived in Norwalk, Connecticut.
Right, so it's not like you're flying her in.
Right, so, you know, box number one was checked off, you know, easy to get to the stadium. So he said, I don't think she'll do it, and I said, well, can I ask why not? And he goes, Rick, she's 80 years old, or almost 80 years old. I said, well, she doesn't have to strike out a batter. She can just hand the ball to the catcher. So he goes, well, I'll ask her, but, you know, don't get your hopes up. Well, the next day she called me. And she, this is exactly what she said. This will be, first of all, she was delighted and she accepted. And she said, Rick, this will be so exciting. I've never been to a baseball game.
Wow.
And I said, what you just said. And I said, never been to a baseball. I mean, how's that possible? You were Eleanor Gehrig in Pride of the Yankees. She goes, yeah, but it was just a role. She goes, you know, a week later, I was on another film, and I've never been a baseball fan. She comes to the game. She gets a wonderful ovation. She meets all the players and this and that and goes home. You know, perfect ending to the story. Except a month later, she's calling me up wondering, what's wrong with Combs? And, you know, why did Joe stick with Boehringer so long? I mean, she became literally, so her son-in-law called me up and said, hey, Rick, we got a problem here, and it's basically your fault. I said, what is it? She goes, this woman won't leave the house if the Yankees are playing. So she became this unbelievable Yankee fan and went all over the, you know, the tri-state area, you know, to screenings of Pride of the Yankees. And I asked her, the baseball writers wanted her to present Derek Jeter with the Toast of the Town Award, the Joe DiMaggio Toast of the Town Award, at the Black Tie Baseball Writers Dinner in 2000. Well, she obviously accepted, and, you know, so she's sitting up there on the dais the whole time next to Jeter. And she presents the award, and she's lovely, and the people give her a tremendous ovation. It was great to have her there. Well, the next morning, her picture's on the front page of the New York Times, sitting on the dais next to Derek Jeter. And she calls me up, and she says, Rick, I'm more proud of having my picture in the New York Times sitting with Derek Jeter than I was when I won the Academy Award.
Come on, wow.
Now, jump ahead, she passes away at the age of 87 or 86 in 2005. Unfortunately, it was during spring training. She'd become a dear family friend. We had dinner many times, you know, my wife and son and her. And when she passed away, her daughter, Mary Kelly, called me up and said, I just want you to know that you gave my mother a reason to live in the final years of her life, because what you didn't know when you called her is almost at that moment, she had made a decision that her career was over. She could no longer travel to act. She couldn't remember the lines as well. Her last movie was the John Grisham's The Rainmaker in like that same year. Mm-hmm. So she said, you gave my mother a reason to wake up in the morning to get the Times and read the box scores.
Wow.
So that's what the great thing about, that's what I remember about having the wonderful fortune of being with the Yankees for 11 years.
Rick Cerrone with us here on the Pinstripe Lanes podcast. Rick, we're doing a lot of content this season around the 10-year anniversary of New Yankee Stadium. Of course, it opened up in 2009. The construction began during your last season in 2006. And of course, obviously, the announcement was before that. What are your thoughts on the new stadium 10 years after it's open?
Well, you know, one of the things I'm very proud of is that because, you know, Lon Trost, the COO of the Yankees, you know, came to me one day with a binder and said, listen, I need you to look at press boxes and you got to fill out this report as to what exactly we tell the architects we need in the press box. So I really feel like I had a big role in the design of the press box, and I'm very proud of that. And also the interview room, you know, where you see Aaron Boone and prior to that Joe Girardi and whatever player it might be that's down in the basement, that wasn't part of the original plans. And I fought very hard for that. And you don't want to build a new stadium that has lesser facilities than the older one did. In the older one, we used to use an auxiliary clubhouse, but now they have this beautiful multi-purpose room, and I'm really pleased about that. My thoughts on the new stadium is it's a beautiful stadium. I see the tweaks that they make to it each year to make it even better. You find out what you need, what you don't need. They've taken some seats out and replaced them with like private cabanas and things, and they fixed that issue they had in center field with the obstructed seats. Mm-hmm. It's a magnificent ballpark, but I'm not sure that any ballpark could live up to the memories that we have of Yankee Stadium. We don't look at the old Yankee Stadium and think about the problems that it had. Most people don't care about the problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, Yankee Stadium, the original Yankee Stadium, in 4 years, the infrastructure would turn 100 years old. The passageways, were very, very narrow. There was no room for anything. There was no room for suites. Its time had come and gone. But the one thing about the new stadium is it's so comfortable for the fans that it loses a little bit of that, it lost its voice, so to speak. But the fans have changed too. I mean, fans go to the game. I mean, here's a perfect example. Fans don't go to the game and keep score anymore.
Right.
Fans at ball games are not as into the games as they are because they want to do a lot of things. I mean, they have a museum there. They have, there's so much to do. But I do think it's a beautiful. I think they did a beautiful job. I'm so happy that they returned the facade. The beautiful what was a copper frieze, and what I don't know what it's made of now, but it kind of gives you the look of the original Yankee Stadium. Because let's be honest, Ralphie, I don't think they did a great job, the city of New York, when they renovated the original Yankee Stadium, because that stadium was nothing like the original stadium. It was far more sterile. But back in those days, people didn't seem to care as much as they do today. I mean, Yankee Stadium in 1973 was more termed a white elephant than it was. It was not considered the cathedral of baseball. It became the cathedral of baseball because of all that happened in its later years and all the history. But it was a very different. I wish people, your listeners, some of them I'm sure did, go to the original stadium, which, closed on September 30th of 1973. But that ball, they were ready to tear that ballpark down. They were talking about moving to Jersey, and then they renovated it, but they made it a much more sterile ballpark.
While they made it more sterile, I think still the big difference between the renovated park and the new park, and especially when the new park first opened, you've mentioned some of the changes. They've made a lot of very small but vital changes since. But even the renovated park, it was still centered around what was happening on the field. It was still really centered around the diamond, and there wasn't a focus on a Yankee museum
Ralphie,
club and suites. Yep,
those days are gone. You can't compete if they built the same ballpark, as the old stadium and didn't have these amenities. They wouldn't be drawing 3 million people. I think to give the Yankees and the people that were responsible for the new stadium, I think it's more evocative of the original stadium than the remodeled stadium was.
Well, see, now, and you're talking to someone who sadly never made it to the right. original stadium. Right. I guess my thing when the new stadium first opened, the obstructed bleacher seats, which obviously they got rid of, those were a terrible look. The art gallery behind home plate, I didn't really care for. And then the idea too. And again, I get it, you know, especially with the amount of tourists that make Yankee Stadium a part of their New York experience. But the idea that we needed a Hard Rock Cafe in Yankee Stadium. I mean, I'm originally from Niagara Falls, New York. My first experiences with live Yankee baseball were up at Sky Dome, and I would never in any way, shape or form want to compare Yankee Stadium to Sky Dome.
Yeah, but let me take the other side of that, right?
Sure.
Fans from across the country, tourists, visitors, whatever, from around the world are coming to Yankee Stadium. Mm-hmm. You know, you get there early to the old stadium, there's no place to go. There's no place to get a hamburger. So I think the Hard Rock Cafe, which, listen, it's not taking up, you know, robbing any space from anywhere else. I think it's a great addition to Yankee Stadium.
That it's a fair and that obviously that's the reason why it's there and why it's stayed
right.
open. You know, I still all these, you know, 10 years later, am not a fan of it being there. That's not to say that I've never stepped foot in there or wouldn't patronize
right.
it, because I have. But to me, the biggest thing that they've done is the removal of, I mean, first of all, the play on the field.
Right.
That's first and foremost. That's reinvigorated the fan base. But mm-hmm. when they got rid of the obstructed bleacher areas and they introduced
right.
the terraces and then the mm-hmm. pinstripe pass, the GA mm-hmm. pass, mm-hmm. really speaking to kind of the trends of what's
right.
happening around baseball, that to me really changed the dynamic of the stadium for the better, and I'm glad they did it.
Well, you know, one thing, getting back to the old stadium, the remodeled one that was open from 76 to 2008, if you look at games, all you see are people.
Yeah.
Because everybody was jammed in there. The upper deck probably seated 20,000. The upper deck at Yankee Stadium probably seats 7,000.
Yeah.
You know, so when you add comfort and you make the seats wider, you don't look at a picture. Like the next time you watch a game from the first base camera, when they show the picture, you don't see, you see things other than people. You see walkways or whatever. But, you know, that's the price you pay for comfort. And now I'm going to be brutally honest here. They just built a massive new stadium in the Meadowlands.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's one of the worst stadiums ever constructed.
Mad Dog said the same thing.
it has destroyed the experience, which I don't even enjoy going to it anymore. It's gray. It's drab. Listen, part of the things I've done in my consulting is with stadiums and with, you know, guest relations and customer relations and everything. And I wish I could, you know, I've never made this call, but I could tell the Giants quite a few things that they need to consider. I mean, I get aggravated before I get to the pay station of showing them my parking pass, because I've got eight guys in the roadway, in the aisles, demanding that I go to this particular pay station when there's nobody in front of me.
We'll wrap a bow on this conversation with, as far as Yankee Stadium, but because you brought up actually a good point that I don't think New Yankee Stadium gets enough credit for, and that is the customer service they provide both via text and throughout the stadium with the "How may I help you" signs and
right.
all the different
mm-hmm.
customer service booths. I think that is a great addition to the stadium, again,
right.
especially for those tourists and those out of towners, and so they should get some credit for that. We're going to wrap up here with Rick Cerrone, editor-in-chief over at Baseball Digest. Before we do, Rick, how about a little preview for the next issue of Baseball Digest? What are you working on?
Well, the next issue, which hits newsstands next week with Bryce Harper and Manny Machado in their spanking new home uniforms of their new teams on the cover. The cover story is, did the Machado and Harper sagas kill free agency? Because basically, a lot of players looked at what they went through and, you know, into spring training and everything and said, I don't want to go through this. We had an agent say, being a free agent used to be like winning a lottery ticket, you know, like having a winning lottery ticket. Now it's like a death certificate. The game has changed, and we definitely address that with a story called Lock 'Em Up, meaning, you know, lock the players up to, you know, to extensions. But we've got a lot of terrific features. The thing I'm most proud of, Ralphie, is that we've got a 10-page fan's guide to ballpark museums and team history. Now, that's never been done before.
Wow.
Where you can go to this one-stop shopping here, and wherever you're going, I'm going to Busch Stadium in St. Louis, here's what they have. I'm going to Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City, here's what they have. Yankee Stadium, Citi Field, all 30. A couple of ballparks don't really have history. The Rangers, for example, are going to have it in their new park in Texas. I'm really proud of that. We've got a wonderful story by Richard Sandomir of the New York Times on how Lou Gehrig's farewell speech, with very few surviving words from it on, you know, film or audio, became baseball's Gettysburg Address. And I think you'll be fascinated how that happened. We've got a wonderful 30th anniversary tribute to two very different baseball movies, Field of Dreams and Major League. Couldn't be more different. But we tell the story about how they have a common theme, and there's a lot of trivia about each film. So it's a fun issue. It's exactly the kind of magazine that I wanted to put out.
BaseballDigest.com for subscription and purchase info. And again, that'll be out next week with Bryce and Manny on the cover. Editor-in-Chief of Baseball Digest, former Senior Director of Media Relations for the Yankees, Rick Cerrone. Rick, as always, thank you for the time, the stories, the insight, the knowledge. Really appreciate you coming on.
Well, I'm happy to do it, and I won't say it as the Mad Dog. So in my way, I will just say, Ralphie, you did an excellent job.
A big thank you to Mr. Rick Cerrone for joining us here on the Pinstripe Lanes podcast. Going to a couple games. I'm so happy the Yankees are back with a homestand. Hopefully we get some good weather. I'll be at Saturday's game, some family in town, and then friend of the show and a guy that we got to have back on at some point, Mike Asurlis, was able to score some tickets, secure some tickets for Tuesday night's game against the Mariners. So I'll be sitting out in right field with him. We thought we were going to be hanging out behind number 99, but yeah, that's not so much the case anymore. Big thank you again for rating, reviewing, subscribing, and listening. This is the Pinstripe Lanes podcast. Let's go, Yankees.